Hello and welcome to the first Misc Inc. Residencies interview. In this series, I'm going to interview the various artists that have come to the Misc Inc. Gallery and headquarters here in Sherbrooke, temporarily in Sherbrooke. Today's featured chat is with artist and friend, Jillian Dykman. Welcome, Jillian.
Thank you.
You've been here now 2 days? 1 day. Full 24 hours.
I've been here, over 24 hours.
Okay, yeah.
Because I got here 10:30 or so yesterday morning.
Okay. Yep.
So far, I have blogged. We have made pizza. We've talked about a few different artists.
Mm-hmm. What is your, I sent you an email like many, many months ago that you responded really quickly to. I invited you to come and do a residency here.
Mm-hmm.
Why? Why were you so eager to accept?
Because I was on a residency at the time and it was a really good experience. I was working only on my art.
Right.
Which is basically, that would be my life goal would
right.
be to be in a situation where the only thing I really have to work on is my art.
Right.
Besides cooking and cleaning and day-to-day things.
Yeah.
That would, my art is my job. Is
right.
I guess my goal.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
Yeah. So, opportunities like this where, I've got time set aside to only work on my art practice are golden.
Yeah.
Because it's, if I'm at home, first of all, I have two jobs. I also have my family and my in-laws. And so if I'm not at one of my two jobs, my time is not necessarily free time for making work.
Absolutely.
And it's all work. So
yeah
there's a lot of things that need to happen.
And so being away from your own space is actually kind of a good experience. Kind of an isolation.
Yeah. We get food and stuff, but what's for dinner all week long isn't really what's on my mind.
Right.
I'm just sort of concentrating.
Yeah.
And I don't have to meet my mom for lunch as much as I like doing that.
Yeah. Do you find that when you were doing a residency at Strutt's Gallery that receiving the invitation at that time while you were in that frame of mind has changed how you approach what you'd like to do here or what you're planning to do here?
I think at that point in time I had a couple projects that I was looking forward to working on next and I thought I would be able to do them here, but I can't take that much time away.
Right.
So I couldn't do those, but I knew that I could really use the time away from my other work, my jobs.
Yeah.
I don't know, I guess I consider my serving jobs to be my jobs and my art practice to be my work, if that makes any sense.
Jobs and works. Well, this is I've got a bunch of questions about that because that seems to be a big theme. I mean, already in a short time, we've had a ton of conversations about work.
Mm-hmm.
And art. I've got a quote, art is work. You also mentioned to me grant writing, that's the name of the game in terms of, that's what your job entails as an artist.
Yeah, big time. Especially because, I make, for the most part, non-commercial work. I've yet to make something that I've sold.
Right.
Doesn't mean I haven't tried.
Yeah.
But it's not my focus at all. So
uh-huh.
If I'm going to be making work that's not commodifiable necessarily, then I need to find other ways to fund that. And
yeah.
That's what, public funding is for that work that's critical and engaged but not necessarily for sale.
Yeah.
It might incidentally be sometimes, but
uh-huh.
for the most part I can't sell what I do.
But that's also become kind of part of the subject in some
mm-hmm.
of your thinking anyway.
Yeah.
For example, we've already discussed, and maybe you can announce that our plans for our teleconference on Tuesday.
Yeah, so we're teleconferencing with two other artists who also, like ourselves, have businesses that they use as modes of either critiquing the business world or the art world and the way that those work. And I think that makes a lot of sense because you know, if you look at what the dominant power is right now for like us here in 2012, mm-hmm. It's corporations. That's mm-hmm. who we feel maybe oppressed by, or maybe that's who we feel like if there were a king, it would be, you know, corporate kings.
Right.
Those are the people, or those are the entities with power now. So modeling oneself after those models of power enables you to critique it or to sort of engage with people in that kind of way, in that business sort of way.
Right.
Which I think we all are kind of interested in some way or another.
Well, it makes sense. I mean, if they, you know, if somebody speaks to you in a different language, you know, it's nice to speak back in the same language, mm-hmm. right?
Yeah.
You know?
Yeah, absolutely.
No, I'm excited for our conversations that we have about this, especially with Kelty and with Karen.
So Karen has a, what's it called,
worker professional, not non-profit.
Okay, was a non-profit.
Well, yeah. A non-profit for business, you know, yeah. A business consulting.
Now tell me about MISC, because you had mentioned that it was a way of distancing yourself from the project somewhat.
Yeah. I mean, it started out as just like sort of an organizational kind of thing.
Mm-hmm.
I was thinking that instead of, you know, a folder on my computer, instead of being Zachary's art,
mm-hmm.
it was a, I just titled it MISC, like miscellaneous.
Mm-hmm.
And that sort of became the name of the organization. And for me, it's not like, you know, like some artists have like band names, sort of.
Mm-hmm.
Thinking of collectives like the Fast Worms,
mm-hmm.
or there's this one that I heard of called Transform Action. yeah. Or Transformasium, excuse me, Transformasium.
Mm-hmm.
But the you know, it's like a way of saying that it's not just me. I'm not just, like, I am not my work. Like,
mm-hmm.
So putting, like, well, for me, it's like kind of like an organizational thing.
It's sort of refuting that idea of, like, artist genius, sort of not placing yourself at the center where the work is interpreted through who you are.
Yeah.
It's sort of, the work hopefully stands alone.
Yeah.
Whether you're a part of it or not.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah.
So, because, you know, that artist genius myth is something that, like, is still pervasive, like, especially I think in the commercial world where you get art stars, you get
mm-hmm.
people who sell their art and then buy mansions, and like,
yeah.
it's because they somehow have some privileged knowledge and ability that no one else has, which is totally ridiculous.
Yeah.
And not true. They wouldn't be able to make the work they do without the context in which they're making it,
mm-hmm.
That, like, you know, everyone has access to.
Yeah.
I still think making art is important, but I don't think it's like a genius thing.
Yeah. And related to that, I think it's interesting, like, artworks that I really enjoy are artworks that develop a life of their own,
mm-hmm.
in a certain way. So to like work for a company or an organization,
mm-hmm.
you know, it implies that you know, it's not necessarily bigger than yourself, but it is separate from yourself, you know, and
mm-hmm.
The father of the MISC, or the mother, I think it's a mother, of the MISC Incorporated was the Miscellaneous Marching Band, the MISC
mm-hmm.
Marching Band, which is something that I felt like did have a project that did have a life of its own.
Do you want to talk about that for a second?
Well, not really. I want to ask you questions.
Oh, okay.
Yeah. But the last note about the MISC thing, the MISC Inc. thing, is that this residency that you're doing
mm-hmm.
is what interests me about it is that this is, you know, MISC Inc. has a gallery space, and the gallery space is my apartment.
Mm-hmm.
And it's not, I guess it's hard to classify it as a real gallery,
mm-hmm.
but I think that it's interesting that your residency is a real residency.
Yeah. Well, doesn't, like, what validates what? Am I validated because I'm doing a residency at the MISC gallery? Like, is that what makes it a real residency, or does me doing a residency make it a real gallery?
Oh, that's really like, you know, yeah.
Well, what you're looking at are like the systems that make art recognizable as art. And so that's something that artists have been interested in since, you know,
in the
60s
or something. Yeah. Oh,
no,
20s.
Yeah.
yeah.
I mean, not everyone picked up what he was saying at that point in time,
sure,
but
sure.
they did eventually.
Yeah.
Yeah. So like, what makes it art versus like a piece of garbage right. on the ground, or right. like art versus like just friends hanging out
yeah.
and talking about art.
Yeah.
Yeah. So, I mean, I'm a professional artist. You're a professional artist. You're curating this residency.
I know. It's interesting that you say it so nonchalantly. Like, it's just so matter of fact, you know?
Yeah.
No,
what else
true.
Would I be? I'm not. Right. I'm not playing. Like, I'm serious, you know.
Yeah. I'm not paying you though.
No, but I don't think that I'm only defined as an artist by getting paid. If that were the case, then
I guess I think that's how we define professionalism, or like, you know, usually.
Yeah. Yeah.
But maybe we need to
renegotiate that. Yeah. I think it's pretty hard to get paid for a lot of the work that we do. I didn't get paid to be at White Rabbit, and in fact, I paid to be there, but. I feel like the art that I made was still part of my practice and important to me.
Yeah.
And like, on that note, I probably could have gotten paid if I had my shit together and gotten a grant.
Right.
So I'm not going to accept that the only way I'm a professional artist is if I'm winning like all the grants I write.
Okay.
Because, you know, real artists, air quotes, could apply for grants their entire lives and like, they're often rejected. They often are not successful, but it doesn't make what they're doing not art.
Mm-hmm.
So, you know, that's interesting.
Yeah. that's my first question. Like the first time, not the first time we met, but the first time I was introduced into your art, to your art
mm-hmm.
practice was at White Rabbit. Did you want to talk about that project a little bit?
Yeah. Sure. So I did a project at White Rabbit. I don't know, just for the people listening.
Yeah.
I'll give it a little context. White Rabbit is an outdoor art festival residency that happens at Red Clay Studios in Economy. Is it Lower Economy or Upper Economy?
I think it's just, I don't remember.
One of the economies in economical Nova Scotia. And it's hosted.
And they didn't even pay you.
No, they didn't even pay you. They get some grants to help run it, I gather. But there's still costs, so the artists are asked to cover like a pretty nominal cost for a week-long residency, which includes food and a place to camp, and lots of artist mentors, which I thought was really, really valuable. It's
mm-hmm.
kind of like camp for artists, except that you do have to do work like while you're there.
Mm-hmm.
And so it's on this beautiful property with apple orchards and beehives and lots of forests and trails and a little stream and the ocean nearby and ponds and, you know, basically a dream come true.
Heaven.
Yeah, basically heaven. So I came with the idea, and just to further note, there's a week-long residency which ends in a day, sort of day or two-day-long festival where the work that's been created all week is presented to the public, then they're welcome to come and stay the night if they'd like, but at the very least come and walk through the woods and see what people have been up to all week. And so I chose to make a Starbucks in the woods. I made hand-painted signs where I very carefully imitated the Starbucks logo.
Mm-hmm.
I made a stand for my barista sort of station, and I used a camp stove to make hand-whisked lattes with stovetop espresso and also percolated coffee. And I had the soy milk, milk and cream and sugars, organic and non-organic,
mm-hmm.
Out. And I also had gotten blank paper cups and hand-carved a stamp of the Starbucks logo, which I stamped on in the like correct color that I mixed myself.
Yeah.
Yeah.
It was very much the right color.
Yeah.
I didn't know you mixed it yourself.
Yeah. Oh yeah. Yeah. Like, cause I didn't have that color green. I had like some similar colors.
Right.
Mixed it. Yeah. So, and then I wore an apron that I made that was green, and I was planning to embroider Starbucks logo, but I ran out of time.
Right.
There's only so much you can do in a
right.
week.
No.
Yeah. So then I ran that as a performance as a barista for about 6 hours of, festival, and it was exhausting, and I had lineups.
I waited in one. Yeah.
Yeah. And it was very popular. It was really interesting the way people engaged with it. I did have one person walk up and see the Starbucks sign hanging from the apple tree, and sort of saying, like, what the fuck? Like, corporate coffee? Like, they were genuinely angry for half of a second before they realized it was art.
Right.
So that was really interesting, yeah, and I was kind of glad success, that that happened. Yeah. Yeah, just like, I tricked you with my hand-painted sign.
That's awesome, yeah.
Yeah. And then I gave everything away, too. It was called a grand opening, and that was, like, sort of the excuse for giving everything away. Right. But
as opposed to, like, charging money.
Yeah, which I felt like I wanted to undermine Starbucks and sort of really get people thinking about the way that not just Starbucks. Starbucks is just, like, a go-to symbol for the sort of pervasiveness of corporations into, like, more and more sort of marginal areas or special spaces that we have, like it's sort of that exchange of cool where, like, Starbucks wants to be cool, so they open up in a cool neighborhood with, like, a bunch of artists in it,
right?
And therefore Starbucks is cool because it's in this cool neighborhood and there's a bunch of artists there, sort of thing.
Or did you see the one in the north end in Halifax?
No, I didn't know that existed.
Yeah, it's right on it's right across from what is that place called? Where Salvatore's Pizza is. What is it? The Hydrostone.
Oh, yeah.
It's, like, all on the other side of the street. In the
Hydrostone. Yeah. So, like, they want to be in the hip neighborhood.
Yeah.
And, you know, similarly, I figured, like, they would love to be at a festival like White Rabbit and get lent, like, that aura of cool, of, like, you know, independent fringe culture. Like, that's something that companies are dying to cash in on.
But it's so completely opposite.
But it's so completely opposite. There's nothing
independent or fringe about it.
Yeah. Absolutely, and like they just want to affiliate themselves with those things.
You've considered how this is another fake business.
Yeah,
you know, exactly. I mean, it's you're borrowing a real business. Questionably, maybe potentially illegal, actually, but
yeah, probably illegal.
Yeah,
like on my website, it's listed not as Starbucks in the Woods, but just as like Cafe in the Woods, and like the images don't have any. Like, I don't want Starbucks to find me. I feel like they will...
Okay.
They would maybe want me to take the images down. Like...
Right.
I had it listed at White Rabbit as Grande Opening.
Grande Opening.
Yeah. That's good. So just kind of trying to stay under the radar, but still well on the radar of the art world, if that makes sense.
Yeah. And like, you don't have to say Starbucks to make it evident that...
Yeah. Like, it doesn't say Starbucks anywhere. It's just the logo, which is very recognizable. It's sort of like a... Like, as McDonald's was in the 90s, Starbucks is in, like, the 2000s.
Yeah.
You know?
Yeah.
Where, like, for a long time, McDonald's was sort of, like, the go-to, like, example of a globalized company. If you wanted to be critical of globalization, you talked about McDonald's. So now we do it with Starbucks.
Yeah.
Because they're more modern.
Right. They're more relevant to today.
Exactly. Yeah. So McDonald's would have been, like, super cheesy. but, yeah, that sort of... making a fake thing a real thing. I think there's a bit of ambiguity there. It's not always clear that you're necessarily being critical. Like, right. I was being critical, but I like that moment of hesitation on the part of people interacting.
Are you playing into it or are you questioning it?
Yeah, exactly. Like, and I think that leaves more space for people to consider what's happening. If I had just made, like, a nice cafe in the woods, there's not really any criticism there. But making it a Starbucks makes it a little uncomfortable to interact with.
Yeah.
Especially if you are sort of feeling like you're anti-globalization or you're concerned about the way that corporations infiltrate our lives and find ways to do that very successfully and sleekly.
Yeah.
I specifically was interested in Starbucks because in my hometown, there have been a lot of Starbucks opening in the last few years.
Okay.
Since I moved away from St. John and moved back, three Starbucks opened. And St. John is not a big town, so that's actually a lot. Like, there are two that are literally, like, a one-minute drive from each other. But they're in this big box land area that is impossible to walk around.
Yeah.
Like these places that are really...
No, they're designed to drive to.
They're designed for vehicles. They're very kind of anti-human.
Yeah.
As far as like, you can't bike in them.
Have you ever, like, do you order food? Have you ever ordered coffee there? Like,
oh yeah. I've been to a Starbucks and it's partly for lack of options in St.
John.
Yeah,
absolutely.
Like,
yeah.
They're open when no one else is open. I really like going for coffee.
Yeah.
But I'm really... Like, it's like this grudging, like, why are you the only people around?
I find it always a very awkward scenario because I refuse to say grande. You know, I refuse to say I would like one grande coffee. You know, it's like I want, you know, a medium coffee or whatever it is. You know, like it just seems like, I don't know, I just call it what it is.
Or, it's just, it's alienating to be like they want you to feel like their coffee culture is special and like only if you are in the know do you know how to order.
Right.
And so people do feel special when they're like, give me like a grande mocha, skinny, half sweet. Like,
yeah, they know all the lingo.
Yeah, and I know the lingo because I've worked at Starbucks.
Oh, yeah?
Yeah, okay. I worked at one at the ski resort. It was sort of a part of a restaurant that was independent, but like they had a Starbucks incorporated in it. And no, that was the only time I worked at Starbucks. And I also worked at a cafe in St. John before Starbucks had opened that did everything in its power to like imitate Starbucks. Like they even like didn't have small, medium, large. They had like tall, moose size, like, and mega.
Okay.
And so it was this small town cafe that was doing everything it could to imitate like a big city cafe like Starbucks.
Yeah.
And I remember when I started working there, sort of questioning why would we call them these stupid size names? And they're like, well, Starbucks does it. And obviously Starbucks is cool. So, you know, from where I was in New Brunswick, people really did look up to like big cities and look up to like these corporations as like harbingers of cool.
Right.
Which is so the opposite of like when you're actually in a big city and there's all these little independent cafes and like beautifully roasted coffee, like way better options.
Yeah.
But yeah, they try to, like, Starbucks does try to have it all. It tries to, like, straddle the, like, indie chic slash, like, slickster cool. Like, they have these different kinds of Starbucks. Like, I'm sure if you could access all of their corporate plans, they would have, like, well, this is the kind that we put in, like, major downtown cities. And it would be, like, you know, way more homey. But, like, in, like, more peripheral towns, they're like, oh, this is super city-ish. And, like, we've got way more dark colors and, like, way sleeker, you know?
Yeah.
I don't know. Maybe I'm wrong, but I suspect as much from like having seen the insides of different ones.
Right.
They're also the same, like no matter where you are.
Yeah.
Like at airports or whatever.
Yeah.
They have it's universal.
Indigo.
Yeah.
Indigo.
Is
it important for you to classify your work? For example, like classify it as conceptual and social practice. We've said that word a number of times in our conversations already. Or like relational.
Mm-hmm.
Is it important to you to define your work as...
like under certain parameters?
Yeah.
I think that the parameters are just useful for communicating.
Mm-hmm.
And it depends on the context. So if I'm talking to other artists who I know are familiar with contemporary art dialogue, I could say, yeah, most of my work's social practice. But if I'm talking to... and you know, non-artist who has no interest or experience with those things, then I might say, oh, I usually work with people and I make installations that people interact with. For example, here's a thing I did.
Mm-hmm.
And I'll talk about a project.
Yeah.
So there's a longer explanation. Those words are sort of just really good shortcuts to get someone on the same page as you.
Yeah.
And, you know, and it moves the conversation forward faster than sort of explaining from point A, you sort of, you know, jump all the way to M.
Right.
As far as like
explanations. But so, I mean,
just so that other artists understand where I'm coming from, I do like those terms. But I'm willing to be flexible about them and update them as like better terms become available. Like I'm not super attached to them.
Okay. Oh, that's interesting. I found like in my personal work, like, for example, discovering the term social practice really, really changed how I viewed my own work.
Mm-hmm.
Because before seeing that term, I didn't really know what it was.
Yeah.
Or I didn't know, I knew what I was interested in, but I didn't know how to classify it.
Mm-hmm.
But the act of classifying it really, really helped me, like,
mm-hmm.
to figure out, I guess I'm just sort of answering the question from my own point of view, but...
Well, like, it helps you articulate what you're doing.
Exactly, yeah. But even at least to myself, you know.
Yeah, but it is like shorthand, because then you don't have to say like, well, I did this thing with people. I don't know if I could call it conceptual art or if I should say that it was a performance.
Yeah.
But yeah, it's like shorthand.
Right.
In the art world.
Yeah.
Yeah, like if you wrote an article and said this is social practice... You don't have to then explain what social practice is. If it's
like lumps all these ideas together, which I guess is the same as true with any term. Like we mentioned futurism earlier, or like, you know, you said Duchamp, and it's like clumps this whole set of ideas, like categorizes ideas.
Yeah. And I mean, that's part of you know, having that background and the education and so on. Like, yeah. you wouldn't be like critical of a doctor for using a term that like refers to a specific family of diseases just because they went to medical school and had right. the knowledge. So right. a lot of the time art knowledge gets, I think, a bad name or like regarded as snobbiness, but it's not snobbiness. It's just part of the profession. Mm. And mm-hmm. it's important to, realize that a big part of our job is also translating for like similarly to how a family doctor would have to explain what a disease means, mm-hmm. Because they've got this specialized knowledge and they understand it thoroughly. An artist who is looking at it or who's making work that's maybe very challenging, you know, it's partly their job to be able to talk about that. Some people might argue that it's more like the critic's job.
Right. Yeah. But do you want your work to be accessible? Like, or do you, like, is it more important for you that your work be like relevant for the non-artistic public or the public who's not been introduced to this sort of contemporary art dialogue? Or is it more important for you that your art contribute to the contemporary art dialogue?
I think both are about equally important. I really try hard to, as we've discussed before, I really like art that's accessible on multiple levels. Mm-hmm. And what I mean by that is, you know, the non, like a person with a no art background could look at it and not feel totally alienated and mm-hmm. just want to walk away.
Yeah.
That they're going to like see something in it and be like, oh, I like that. Maybe I don't know why, but, you know, or, oh, I, you know, you can have a reaction that's not just positive, but like at least some sort of engagement. But there might be some little things in there that are art nerdy and like,
yeah,
you know,
yeah.
your peers are going to get it or, right. Or they would refer to like contemporary culture in some way
mm-hmm.
that like, they're not just like necessarily in jokes or something like that. It's a bit, there's a bit more to it than that, but I really hope to make work that's going to be something that people feel like they can talk to me about,
mm-hmm.
Without, feeling intimidated. Like I try to make it somewhat welcoming.
Right.
If that's possible.
Right.
Yeah. And
we talked about mean art too, which even though it can be like
legit or whatever,
it can fit the rules of the sort of contemporary or like the cutting edge ideas,
mm-hmm.
but it can be, you know, it's sort of like
a jerk
move.
Yeah, there was this there's this really good interview with Lawrence Wiener where he says, this is a quotation from it, he says, "I believe in the positive gesture," and so he's not necessarily talking about feel good, like, oh, bunnies and flowers, you know, only
you're
positive.
Yeah.
But what he means by that is like the idea of like, you know, if the world is like some sort of void and you're interacting with it, you're not taking something just away, you're contributing.
Yeah.
And I think that when you make art that's like alienating and, you know, just kind of fucks with someone's day, I think that's like a negative gesture, and like I don't really see the point in doing that. There's enough negativity, like I don't want this to sound flaky, like there's enough of that kind of experience in people's lives that like why would, like, art doesn't need to fulfill that role, but like it's a lot more challenging to do something I think that's going to be engaging and interesting and that positive gesture.
Mm-hmm.
Like, it can still be critical, absolutely, and it might even be upsetting, but like if there's space in there to think about things and not just walk away feeling upset,
right,
that's important.
Right.
Yeah.
I mean, I'm thinking about like you know, like what CEO of Starbucks, what's his name, do you know? I forget. I listened to it already.
Starbuck.
What would Mr. Starbucks say if he came across your Starbucks piece, you know, like a,
yeah.
Like, I mean, or maybe a better example is somebody who works at Starbucks.
Yeah.
You yourself are one, right?
Yeah. I don't know. They might just feel a little weird about it, which is good. Like, you should feel weird about working at Starbucks.
Right. But they wouldn't necessarily feel, like, affronted by your your piece.
Yeah. They wouldn't. I don't think they would feel like, oh, this is so mean.
Right.
They'd be like, weird. Why would you make a fake Starbucks?
Yeah.
And I want them to really think about, well, why would you? And like, that's, yeah. And I don't necessarily want to give them an answer either. I just want them to think about it.
Yeah.
and think about, like, well, why am I working for Starbucks? Mm-hmm. Like, maybe they have all other alternatives. Maybe they don't. Like, you know, most people working for Starbucks are making, like, minimum wage, and, like, it's not their dream job. And, right. You know, that company just certainly, like, again, could probably afford to pay people a living wage if they wanted to.
Mm-hmm.
Probably could afford to have only fair trade coffee, which they choose not to.
Right.
Probably could do things a lot more environmentally friendly, probably could not put small cafes out of business if they chose to.
Yeah.
But they're a corporation. At the end of the day, a corporation's job is to make money.
Mm-hmm.
And if they choose to do things that are not going to make them money, you know, they suffer at the hands of their shareholders.
Right.
Like, that's the only thing they're accountable to, is making more money. And there's a problem when, like, these entities that are so powerful, their only prerogative is to make money.
Yeah.
And that's the case. And I think that's why we're all taking on this sort of corporate role and doing other things with it.
Mm-hmm.
Like, there's nothing about MISC that's all about making money,
no.
Which is sort of funny, because that's really the only reason you should have a corporation,
right.
Is because you want to have this entity making money,
yeah.
and generating cash, as,
yeah.
if cash is the only thing that's valuable,
right.
or, you know,
yeah.
monetary value
it's
being
like
the only thing that matters.
It's like a meme. You're familiar with the term meme?
Mm-hmm.
It's a sort of an item of information that reproduces itself in the same way that a gene reproduces itself, or is gets passed down through biological organisms.
Mm-hmm.
A meme gets passed along through advertising. You know, a jingle gets caught in our head, or a clever ad we see on the bus, like, gets stuck in our head, and we think about it, and we keep coming back to it.
Mm-hmm. Or
but like a business is the kind of thing that is, like, self-reproduces,
mm-hmm.
because it self-reproduces. Like, a business is something that, because it makes money, it expands
to make more money, yeah, regardless of, like, environmental consequence, labor consequences, you know,
putting small businesses out of work,
yeah. Exactly. Like, it's not accountable to humanity the way that people are.
Right.
Like, if you're a person and you go kill someone, you're in trouble. But if you're a business and you make decisions that indirectly affect people and eventually they die, it's a lot harder to persecute the business.
Don't go to jail. The business, the whole business doesn't go to jail.
Exactly. I think it should.
Right. Yeah. No.
Absolutely. Morally.
Yeah, absolutely.
Like, I think that if we're going to treat corporations as persons under the law, which we do, they should
through taxes and stuff, right?
Yeah, they should also be accountable as persons.
Yeah.
To the law. Like, if a person did that,
yeah,
they should go to jail.
Right.
So if a corporation.
No, that's super cool. I totally agree. So we've talked a lot about work and a lot about business.
Mm-hmm.
I'm wondering if play has a role in your artwork as well.
Yeah, it does. I'm not sure why. I think because that's part of making it accessible, is having a playful element, having something that's not necessarily super serious, but it is at the same time.
Hmm.
I talked about a quotation I can't remember who said it first, but art being the most serious form of play.
Mm, yeah.
Because if it's just a straight message, that's really boring. Like, you need to leave room for intellect to fill in sort of the gaps and to make... to formulate questions and to come up with their own answers and so on. And that's really what play is sort of like, I'll throw you the ball and you catch it. Or like, or you could, like, make a hoop with your arms and I'll throw it through. Or like, those kinds of things work really well in art. If you sort of say, well, I'm going to set this up, you engage with it. And that's where the play is, sort of like, I'm going to make a fake Starbucks. You can come up and order from me as if I'm a Starbucks.
Yeah.
And so people play along.
Yeah.
And the same with the letters. It was sort of like, I will write...
Just to explain what the...
Oh, yeah. So I did a residency at Stratz Gallery in Sackville this fall, where I had written to each of my Facebook friends and asked them if they would give me their address and I would in turn write them a letter. And so most people responded positively. I had a few non-responses and only one no. But people were like, yes. So I sort of, you know, it's the same kind of thing. Like, I'll throw you the ball. Will you catch it?
Mm.
And they've responded, yes, I will. And then a bunch of people have written back subsequently.
Wow.
So that's been really nice too. And like a part that I wasn't counting on in any way.
Yeah.
But it's been really nice. So yeah, like that moment of will you catch the ball is like, I think what a large part of what makes it social practice is sort of like, will you engage?
Yeah.
I'm going to leave this space for you to engage. Will you occupy it?
Yeah.
You know, it takes a certain amount of like faith in humanity, which I really like to exercise because I feel like we live in a pretty cynical world and it's a lot easier to just be cynical and to not have that faith and to sort of, you know, alienate yourself and alienate other people. That's easy. Easy, and I also think it's cowardly, and I'm not afraid to say so.
I was about to admit to that, like, wholeheartedly. I admit to being cowardly.
I don't think you're cowardly.
But
like,
anyway.
It takes a lot of courage to be like, I'm just going to put a parade together. Like, I'm going to put a marching band together.
Okay.
You know?
And I think more recently I've become a little bit more cynical.
Yeah.
But I really like this idea of exercising faith in humanity. I think there's something really beautiful about it, you know.
Yeah, there is, and people do respond to that positively, like most of the time in my experience. And if they ever don't, then I have to sort of think, well, what am I doing that's not welcoming enough? Like, what about this project doesn't invite people in enough, and how can I make it different so that it does?
Yeah.
And yeah, so it's artists, non-artists, whoever will interact with it, I'm excited that they will.
Yeah.
Yeah, so I've got some things coming up next, like the corporate office spaces that I'm making. I think by making them on tree houses, it gives you a space for your imagination to sort of go occupy that. Like, what if offices were really like this? But then what I'm actually saying is, like, what's wrong with offices? Like,
right.
What's with offices? Why do we have these spaces? Why do we make people live in these kind of, like, the way that offices normally are, which
cubicles
are
cubicles and
and like, what's like, they're so anti-human, like, and I worry that there's something about the way those spaces are structured that exercises like a certain amount of control over people's behavior and sort of modifies their behavior. And so by mounting them on treehouses with, you know, tire swings and rope ladders, it's sort of, it puts that, just to bring it back, it puts that element of play into it. And just like, well, what if offices were like this? What if, like, you know, I had to climb up a rope swing to get to my computer? Like, how would I be a different person in the world? Like, you know, or would people be more accountable to their common humanity if their daily experience was more commonly human?
Yeah. No, that's great.
Maybe not.
I don't know. I think so. I think definitely so. I'm thinking about my own 9-to-5 job, you know, and how it's so, like, the idea that you show up to work every day from the same hours and give a consistent amount of energy is so, like, robotic.
Yeah.
You know, like, and I know that I, you know, every afternoon I have this, like, hour-long moment where I'm not productive.
Yeah, just lull in energy.
Yeah.
So realistically, it'd be nice if you could just take a nap and, like, take 5, go home, put up your feet, you know?
Totally.
But, like, that doesn't fit within, like, you know, time sort of parameters for when you should be working.
Right.
And I think that's
whack.
It'd
be so frowned upon.
Yeah.
So frowned upon.
If, absolutely.
Like, my coworkers came into my office and there I was, like, having a snooze. Like,
yeah.
On my desk.
And I mean, like, people love order, but why do people love order? And, like, what makes them so insecure about disorder? And why are they scared of I think they're scared of disorder. And people worry about disorder because they want to know that they're going to have a meal on their plate every night. They want to know that they have enough money to retire on. They want to know that they have enough money for a lot more things than they actually need.
Mm-hmm.
And that's part of, like, the trade off.
Right.
You sort of, you know, a lot of artists make work about trading labor for money. Like I told you about that minimum wage machine. I forget the artist who did it, but it was a vending machine that if you stood there all day long turning the knob, it could put out pennies at a rate that matched minimum wage.
Okay.
And it's just sort of like, talked one about minimum wage, but two about, like, the way that you trade your time for money.
Hmm.
And that's something I'm really resistant to, and it's not always, I mean, the consequences are not easy to deal with all the time, but like, I came here instead of working for a week, and so I'm giving up my money, I guess, but to do something that is a lot more valuable to me than making that money, which I didn't need because I've already made enough money this month to pay the bills, sort of thing. Like, so it's always a bit of a trade-off, and like, you can't escape that. Like, there's no... Like, people try. And I don't think that the solution is to have some sort of utopic farm off-grid with a, where you're growing your own food all the time. In a lot of ways, I do feel like that's a solution, but that's totally privileged and unrealistic for most people.
Right.
So what about everybody else?
Yeah.
You know, like, yeah. What's the solution for everybody?
Yeah.
And I think it's to keep questioning and to, like, know that you can find those solutions and that these things are possible and, like, there are alternatives. There's certainly an alternative economy that's happening all the time that the government would love to get its hands on.
Okay.
They, like, I've seen ads that, like, say that the alternative economy is undermining Canada, which is, of course, ridiculous.
And I think it could be so powerful. That...
Yeah, like, the alternative economy can't be taxed because it's invisible to the tax man. But the amount of dollars that they would make from these small interactions are so minimal, and, like, then it's not undermining the Canadian economy in any way.
Of course not.
But I love doing it. I love to undermine the economy. It's my favorite. Like, you know, if you can trade things, if you can, like, just exchange things that are not monetary for other things that are not monetary. Like, if you can trade foods with people, that's cool. Like, I'd love to get into more bartering over my lifetime. If you can find ways around buying things, like borrowing furniture from people, borrowing is really important.
Yeah.
But being a good borrower and lender is also important. And, like, those are not values that are taught really well. It's, you know, like, in university, there should be classes on how to be a good borrower and lender. Instead of like some of the stuff that
that wouldn't go down very well. Like,
yeah.
kiss your like government subsidies goodbye at university.
Yeah. So how to be a good borrower and lender of non-monetary things.
Yeah.
Maybe we'll do that as an art project.
Okay.
Teach it.
teach lending.
Yeah. Teach lending and
rules
and
principles for
lending and borrowing. See, and, like, that's a, you know, of course it's art. It's like, what other use is it?
Nah.
I don't know.
Is social media important to your work?
It was in my last piece.
Well, directly about.
Yeah, which, you know, looked at Facebook. And I met with a friend recently who was like, oh, like, I hate Facebook. I hate it. It makes me not really connect that well with people. It's all sort of suggesting that it was an inferior way of communicating versus letter mail. Because he was sort of like, oh, your letter mail, like, it was so special, like... blah blah blah. And then in the end of the conversation, I pointed out that I could not have done this letter writing project without Facebook. So I think that part of what I was pointing out was, like, the potential for these social networks to actually be something quite positive and amazing if only they're activated as such.
No, that's interesting.
Yeah. So that's something I look at doing too, is, like, activating spaces.
I mean,
places.
I think the first my first reading of that piece was like, your friends interpretation of, like, Facebook is an impersonal way of communicating and distances us. But it's interesting that it's actually, like, you know, you say, like, it has potential and it can really be...
Yeah. Well,
it can really facilitate that.
I think a lot of that potential was manifested with, like, the Arab Spring, right? Like, so much of those protests were planned over Facebook.
Yeah.
And that is where it's a really valuable and amazing thing for humanity. It also has great potential to be super alienating. Again, like, the ads are really offensive sometimes. You get way too much information. Facebook for me right now, and this is something I've said a few times before, but not to you, is that we're in this space of negotiation with it. So my go-to example about that is the movie You've Got Mail. Are you familiar with this movie?
It's very old. Tom Hanks or something?
Yeah. It's from the 90s. Meg Ryan and Tom Hanks.
From the days of AOL. This is like...
Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah. And like, really blatant marketing.
Yeah.
You know? anyway, Tom Hanks and Meg Ryan play these two characters who are both bookstore owners. And Tom Hanks owns, like, a Chapters-esque bookstore. And he's opening it around the corner from Meg Ryan's children's bookstore, which is called, like, the little bookstore around the corner.
Right.
You know, so they sort of antagonize each other in person. But online, they're carrying on this friendship. And meanwhile...
Anonymously.
Yeah.
I have seen this movie a very long time.
Yes. But meanwhile, they both have actual relationships happening, like romantic partners, respective romantic partners, but are carrying on with each other online with these sweet little emails back and forth. And at that point in time when the movie was made, it was still debatable whether that counted as cheating to like have like this kind of intense actual romance going on online. And in the movie, someone actually asked that question at some point in time, like, is it cheating if it's online? And it's just sort of dismissed by all of the characters. They don't really address it. And throughout the movie, conveniently, you know, the romantic partners of these people go their separate ways. It never comes down to the fact that there's this online relationship happening.
Just find themselves as single and then...
Yeah, and then they realize who each other are in person, and then they get together.
Of course.
You couldn't make that movie now because there's nothing sweet and innocent about this carrying on online. Like, it's very clear, we know that as a culture,
right,
that if you carry on online with a person in a romantic fashion, that is, you know, not being, like...
honest to your...
Yeah, honest to your...
monogamous partner.
Yeah, monogamous partner. So, assuming you're in a monogamous relationship, or if you were in a monogamous relationship where having a relationship with another person was not okay, then... having an online relationship with another person is not okay.
Qualifies.
Yeah. And so I make an effort to say in person because a lot of people still use terms like online versus in real life. To me, online is real life. And so when I'm trying to make a distinction between things that happen online and things that happen not online,
in person.
Yeah. Yeah. So, but at that point in time, that was very much negotiable.
Right.
So I think that similarly, Facebook is being negotiated right now. Like, it's nothing to do with relationships or anything like that, but what people post, how frequently they post, their own security settings, who they're friends with, the kind of ads that are going to appear, the frequency with which people use this social networking device or network. All those things are very flexible. They're in flux. Some people...
Is it safe to say that as we propel ourselves consistently, forever, permanently in the meme speed, in the same speed, there's a little French kind of, the same speed into the future, that it'll always just be in flux, we'll always just be navigating new technologies and new information.
Yeah, but I think that Facebook will at some point get in check, where like it's been a very successful company because it keeps changing, but at some point in time, people will mostly probably use it in the same way.
Right. It'll be like a Facebook code of conduct.
Exactly. So like we've got an email code of conduct pretty well established. It's still like somewhat being negotiated, but like it's totally okay to send like a one-line email. But like years ago that might have been really rude for some people.
Absolutely.
Like that's not a good letter. Why would you write me an email like that?
Right.
So people are sort of coming to grips with this new technology. And yeah, I think Facebook eventually will sort of come to grips with. When I first had Facebook, like I said, there was no advertising. Also, none of my relatives were on it. So the kinds of things I were posting were like, yeah, party. Like, this is me drunk. And like, I would never, ever put that on Facebook now because potential future employers can see it. I have all my security settings on like maximum and I make an effort to update those.
Okay.
I screen the friends that I have.
Yeah.
Like, I'm not a big deleter. Once you're a friend, you probably get to stay that way. But I'm really careful about who I let be my friend.
Right.
My friend. A lot of people use air quotes.
Air quotes.
Which I also find interesting.
Mm-hmm.
I think I was trying to make them all my friends, partly, by writing, like, maybe they are my friend. Mm-hmm. If I can write someone a letter, they've got to be a friend, right?
Yeah.
I don't know. I still don't have the answer to that one.
Okay, so I have one last question here, and we've kind of talked about it ourselves, but I thought it might be nice to have it on the microphone. Your husband is a painter, and I'm interested in how your work affects his work and vice versa.
Mm-hmm.
Especially since the forms seem so dramatically different. Like, do you work with people? He works with paint. Like, it's kind of like, you know, and he has this, like, huge, I mean, to a certain extent, you have this sort of, like, you follow what's come before you, what has come before you, but he has much more of that to deal with, I think.
Mm-hmm.
But you know, how does the work inform yours? I guess that's the question.
I'm not sure how our work informs each other, or like, we just inform each other as artists, and like critical sort of analysis plays into both. We have similar backgrounds in that we both went to NASCAD, mm-hmm. and you know, would have taken art history there, but Jared also has a history degree, and I also have a bunch of BA, like in environmental studies and feminist literature and different things. So it means that it's easy to have a critical conversation about whatever we're working on, whether it's painting or social practice or whatever.
Mm-hmm.
Like on paper they look like very different things, but in a lot of ways they're not. Like mm-hmm. they're both looking at participating in that contemporary art dialogue, mm-hmm. Engaging with contemporary culture. So Jared does that through paint. I do that with the kind of work I do. And at some point in time, I actually have a project that does involve painting. But mm-hmm. again, it's just like another tool in my tool belt. Whereas right. for Jared, he just really, like, it's like painting is his favorite tool, but we're both doing art making.
Right.
So, like you said, like on paper they look like different things, but like they don't, and they manifest differently, but they're all coming from the same kind of place where like we're both making work that like he's concerned about, you know, the way that the historical or the way that history gets constructed through image making, and so he makes images that sort of hope to sort of disrupt that and like give you that moment of like what's actually happening here,
mm-hmm.
and like it's sort of like that moment of play that I talked about, but that's what he like is also seeking to do with painting, is that like you're gonna have to look at this painting a little bit longer to figure out what's happening, and maybe you won't quite figure out what's happening, and maybe it'll make you think a bit more about the image, because they're all images that, or for the most part they're images that have a lot of historical weight. So he'll do mm-hmm. different like very recognizable political figures,
mm-hmm.
but put them on like a very uncertain kind of background,
right?
So yeah, like I can talk about his work quite easily and understand it quite easily,
right.
And I can, you know, similarly, I think that the main thing it does for me is it means that I have to think about painting in a way that, like, if I was only with a bunch of other social practice artists all the time, I might be dismissive of painting. But it's sort of like that's, I think, what family does for me too. It's like, and that's why I care about making work that's accessible, because I care about my family. Like, they don't have a BFA, they don't have any art history background, hardly at all, like, but I want them to be able to see what I'm doing and not feel alienated, and so they make me accountable, and like Jared makes me accountable to the other kinds of art that happen, and I make him accountable to the other kinds of art that happen, so that he's not just off in geeky painting world caring about like the way that the paint goes on the canvas,
mm-hmm.
he also has to care about what's happening in the art world,
right.
which he might do. Like, arguably, he'd probably do that even if I wasn't around.
Right.
But it's certainly more, you're confronted with the different kinds of art that happen more frequently when you've got someone in your life who's working in a way that's very different, technically.
Mm. Mm-hmm. Yeah, that's interesting.
Yeah.
Julian, thank you very much
for
this interview. We may continue, I guess.
We'll call this part one.
Part one.
There'll be other conversations.
Yeah, and...
let me know if you have other questions.
Yeah, of course. We'll come across it, I'm sure, in our discussions as we continue.